This is Brass Tactics, policy and strategy for the people, not the politics.
Because we're still talking a long game, right?
Welcome back to Brass Tactics, the show where I spend about 3 hours editing because Pete has no self-regulation capability whatsoever.
That's what I bring to the table.
This week, unlike what Pete clearly thinks is going on, we are not talking Chinese strategy because that is not the guest we brought on today. As a matter of fact, with us in the virtual recording booth is Sean Marquis, returning for another crack at the military-industrial complex. Sean, how are you doing?
Hey, Joe. Hey, Pete. Thanks for having me on again. Excited to get to talk a little brass tactics.
And our listeners are excited to hear you do it. All right. So, Sean, the last time you were on with us, we talked a lot about innovation, and we did some good learning stuff. But we definitely kept it much more conceptual. So this time around, just because there's been a whole lot of stuff in the news specifically about one of those key areas to the innovation puzzle, the military-industrial complex. Right before this, I was scrolling through first two articles I came across was Forbes magazine talking about this is no time to supersize the military-industrial complex. And then a student newspaper had the University of Southern California, San Diego or San Francisco, talking about how the similar thing, like we absolutely should not, we should cancel the military-industrial complex. And on the other side of the table, we had the Defense News article that we had talked about when it came out about a week or so ago, talking about how the military-industrial complex needs to change because it's not where we need it to be right now. All that to say, so tell us again what a prime contractor is.
That's a great question. So I'm going to give you an answer. I encourage anyone listening to Google spot check me on this one because I'm not entirely sure. I think a defense prime contractor is a contractor who basically the entirety of their business is defense-oriented material through the U.S. government. So they might be a private enterprise, but they're not a private enterprise that just sells to anybody and everybody. They're a private enterprise that works directly for sort of the defense establishment.
More specifically, the reason they call it a prime contractor as opposed to a defense contractor, because this ties back into, because there's essentially only, I don't know what Pete's Googling over there, but there's only five of them now, give or take. I can't even name that many because there's a lot. Don't you throw 11s at me right now, Peter. I will finish this thought and we will stay on topic. Lockheed Martin, right? Boeing. I can't even, I thought there was a third one I could name there, but it's Northrop Grumman. Back in the day, prime contractor means they're the ones who actually get the contract from the government itself, from the DoD. And then they can subcontract it out to smaller companies like Honeywell to make an engine for them. General Dynamics might be another big one.
I thought it was a difference of how much they work with the government, though, not their size. I thought prime contractors work directly with the government, and then they have subcontractors who then kind of are subordinated to them.
Yeah, that's literally what I just said. The prime contractor.
Yeah, but you see, there's only five of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got them right here. So we got Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman.
I only missed Raytheon.
Those are the big five. And to Joe's point, I think there's a couple different aspects here, right? So there's a whole lot of other. There used to be 50 towards the end of the Cold War, but they all got consolidated. So within Lockheed Martin, got a whole bunch of other things that used to be prime contractors. Now they're just subordinate parts of Lockheed Martin. In addition, is that 50 that have existed that are now parts of those other companies. I'm tracking what you're saying, Joe, is these guys can also go out and find other entities that don't typically work with government and subcontract them to do work as well.
Yeah, it's like the prime sounds a lot cooler than it is. It's literally just like a regulation term, meaning like they're the in the building industry terms, they're the general contractor, and then they manage a bunch of subcontractors, or they handle it all in-house through their own contracting firm. Prime just means they're the ones who the Department of Defense actually awarded the contract to. But yeah, so right at the end of the Cold War, in 1993, the powers that be sat down with some of the industry leaders for the military-industrial complex and were like, listen, Cold War is over. They're already coming at us with knives at the budget. We literally cannot sustain this 50-51 broad military-industrial base, so you all are going to need to consolidate. And so in the interest of mutual survival, they consolidated. And then since 1993, they consolidated even more. Like, at one point, there were three major firms that were still building ships. Now we're down to two. There still used to be up until the middle of the Iraq-Afghanistan conflicts, there used to be two major tracked vehicle fabricators, and now there is only one. And so a lot of this breadth was all collapsed in the interest of we didn't see a functional purpose to that anymore.
And economy of scale too, right? Because it's getting more profitable when you have, you know, one company doing more of it, right?
But they were having one company doing less of it, though. So really, the military-industrial complex essentially was forced into a survival mode. I'm not saying that they didn't still find like lucrative opportunities, but
okay,
all of their demands went way down. And one of the things Sean talked about a lot with us when he was on about innovation was how a sense of competition, rivalry, and oftentimes also just losing another conflict are some of those catalysts that force innovation. And one of the things that went out the window when we had to downsize to five and significantly reduce the demand on our military-industrial complex was competition. There's only five of them left, right? And they don't all specialize in the same thing. You know what I mean? Like, HII pretty much just builds ships. Lockheed Martin and Boeing pretty much just build airframes. You see where I'm
going? And missiles.
And,
pieces of airframes.
And Raytheon also builds missiles, but also kind of has a lock on the radar industry.
Yeah, they make pretty much all radars in this country. Yeah.
So it's not that they don't compete with each other at all, but they all have their like zones where they are king. And I think a lot of what we missed because of that, especially when you compare our military industrial base to China's, is that lack of competition, more so than the lack of size or the lack of depth of companies, or the lack of budget to invest in better technologies, is really, I think that's been the biggest drag as a secondary unforeseen consequence to this necessary downsizing.
Could I play devil's advocate to both of you really quickly? But what if the nature of war now, because it's becoming hyper-technical and hyper-specialized, has made the barrier to entry for military-industrial companies so much higher than in the past? Because say 150 years ago, Sean and I could start a rifle making operation in our garage, you know, like a lot of guys did, like Henry Spencer, Craig Jorgensen. You could just start doing that because you could do it with basic machine tools. Nowadays, though, the whole apparatus just to get into it and just get a contract awarded is so much higher that now only the biggest and most flush with cash companies can even try.
To that point, I would say I feel like the way things work now are kind of evidence of the opposite. Most of the military at one point created Velcro, created axle grease or margarine or whatever, created GPS. Like, the military was the lead source of innovation for a very long time. It's no longer that anymore. And I think that's part of the competition. And then to your point, people are doing that. People are building drones and crap in their garage. And the Army is over here, the Navy, Air Force are buying commercial off-the-shelf products because the private sector stuff has definitively outpaced us. And so now we're looking at, and I see you talked about this when we talked about Ukraine and innovation. You're seeing people rig these commercial off-the-shelf drones for military use. They're just improvising because the military technology didn't outpace or even keep pace with the private sector. Over to you, Sean.
Now we're into a zone I feel good on, right? So here's the thing. You're both kind of right, right? So to Pete's point, when we talk about some of the biggest, most technological weapon systems, right? So whatever we're talking, electronic warfare systems, radar systems, the best, you know, missile systems and this sort of stuff. Yeah, you can't just really make that up in your backyard anymore. Like that stuff really is like those prime contractors really have an edge, and it's going to be really hard to try to break in. You know, nobody's going to crack the stealth aircraft market out of those guys' hands anytime soon in all likelihood, right?
Didn't Australia like float a cardboard one that technically did the same thing? A cardboard drone that defied radar profile?
Peak Aussie tech.
You know, similarly, right? So we hear about, you know, in Ukraine, there's a lot of the stuff of like, hey, you know, look at what all these small commercial off-the-shelf drones are doing and this sort of stuff. But then, you know, you look at the capabilities that can come out to stop them and you realize that, you know, some of those things look pretty decisive or really effective on the battlefield now. But if you took some of these prime contractors and you said, hey, we want systems that do X, Y, or Z to handle these things, they've got much more capability to come up with technological solutions to solve those problems rather than just, hey, small drones that can drop hand grenades or do, you know, FPV stuff is really effective. So we need to be able to do that too. Well, do we need to be able to do that too, or do we need to be able to counter that, right? Because we don't necessarily want to do the same thing. We might want to be able to do something better or just take away that thing that our adversary has, right? So, you know, you see a lot of references when you look at, you know, Russian or Ukrainian sources where they're talking about, you know, hey, these things are really effective with electronic warfare for stopping these drones, knocking them out of the air. But when you look at the really high-end military drones, the EW is not effective against them. Or, hey, we've got low-end electronic warfare stuff that's really good against a lot of commercial off-the-shelf drones. But then, you know, you do a couple small things and you can overcome it. Whereas they all say, hey, if you've got the really good military-grade electronic warfare systems, it's much more effective. So it's sort of a, you know, low-end commercial off-the-shelf stuff and some technologies can provide some really useful stuff for the battlefield, and that's absolutely true. At the same time, some really high-end military capabilities are still important, and I think these contractors provide that. That said, I love the point that you brought up, Joe, in terms of, like, where is new, like, groundbreaking science and innovation coming from? And it's generally not those guys. Right. If we're looking for, you know, moderately better stealth aircraft, moderately better missile, things like this, like, okay, yeah, because that's in their wheelhouse, they've got tons of resources, tons of people who have worked in that wheelhouse for forever. Those contractors are great at those sorts of things. But historically, right, these developments have come from, you know, government-funded research laboratories going all the way back to World War II, right? The government-funded tons of scientific research. And it wasn't scientific research that was just, hey, we need you to make a nuclear bomb. A lot of it was just, we're going to fund all kinds of base level scientific research, because eventually coming out of that scientific research will be useful things that we can militarize, and we'll do that, right? Whereas now the proportion of money that's going into research and development from the government sector and government research labs and academic labs is a fraction of what comes from venture capital. Venture capital is investing way more. And importantly, they're investing in the stuff that we think is going to be the edge in the future battlefield, right? Things like AI, robotics, these sorts of things, like especially AI, right? The people who are specializing in that, it's not those prime contractors. It's Google, it's Amazon, it's Tesla, whatever. I don't know, right? But like, who's creating the best chips or conducting AI? That's NVIDIA. We just saw their stock explode over the last month as everyone's realized, like, oh boy, these guys have the edge in making chips for the AI market. So they're going to be hugely important in the future.
And we have to onshore it too, right? Because we can't trust that to be not made locally because it's so vital to the war effort.
Yeah, which is tough, right? Because it's not onshored right now, right? The companies might be U.S. companies, but, iPhones, perfect example. Apple might be a U.S. company, but where do they get all their phones built? China, right? They have their phones built in China. They're trying to get them built in India, but it's not as easy as just saying, hey, India, can you build these things? There's a lot that goes into developing a manufacturing sector that's capable of handling that kind of volume and technicality.
Going back to your point about those big prime contractor companies, right? From that Defense News article that sort of sparked the inspiration for this episode, I think they pulled a perfect vignette that sort of illustrates what you're saying, Sean. Secretary of Defense Gates, I think it was 2013, the mine-resistant armor-plated vehicle, MRAP, is that what it stands for? I can't remember.
MRAP, yeah, mine-resistant armored personnel.
IEDs ended up everywhere. And at one point, we're like, okay, we need to equip MRAP haulage and MRAP vehicles for all standard operations outside of the wire, outside of our forward operating bases. And people point to that and are like, all right, the industry surged to meet that need. But to your point, like this was essentially the blueprint was already tested, created, validated, and we needed sheer production. But another thing to think about there is we spent the better part of this century has been dedicated from the U.S. perspective to perfecting counterinsurgency and counterinsurgency technology. And a lot of this discussion about expanding the military-industrial complex, which necessitates the opposite camp arising as well, of we need to stop investing in the military-industrial complex, it's relative to the threats we see now, namely China, and how in the same 30-year span where we cased our military-industrial complex from 51 all the way down to 5, they have just grown exponentially and pose a significant threat to some of our interests, especially overseas. I'm not sure where I was going with that. Somebody can start talking now.
So the one thing that's really beneficial for China is that in China, if their government wants to work with private enterprise, all the government has to do is say, hey, you're working with us now, right? And it's done. That's not the way we operate here in our free market. Our government, in times of war or national emergencies, there's things that they can do to make. Because the biggest thing that we struggle with, right, is how do you get companies to work with the DOD? And as much as we might be, people politically divisive, oh, maybe people don't want to work for the military, and you see some really high, to make our private enterprise work on the government's behalf in certain ways, but that's not our typical operating environment for our market, right? And so that's an advantage that China has that I think we've seen the DOD start to work really hard to try to make up for. Really up their articles about, hey, look, Google engineers say they don't want to work for the DOD because they don't want to contribute to warfare or whatever, right? There's some cases like that. I don't think that's the biggest problem. I think the biggest problem is that people don't know how to work for the federal government, right? If you're a small business, if you're an entrepreneur, it's not easy to do things like DOD contracts and that sort of stuff. And I think that's the biggest hurdle to better integration between all of these other small companies that are working on this new developing tech. But the good news is I think the DOD has kind of realized that. And so they've started to fund various entities to try to get after that. One of the biggest ones is the Defense Innovation Unit. So, They were stood up, I think, maybe under Gates, but it was right around that same time frame, right? 2013. And throughout most of their existence, small budget, but that budget just exploded this past year. I'm not sure if the bill was passed or if it was just, you know, one section of Congress had passed it. But I want to say their budget went from something like $10 million to $100 million, something of that sort of scale. But their whole job, the Defense Innovation Unit, is basically they've got hubs, one in Silicon Valley. I believe there's one in like Boston, and then maybe another one like Austin. And then they're starting to have more, they're spreading fingers out in more places and that sort of stuff. I haven't kept up on it very well. But their job is basically, hey, we want you to go out and find the startups, find the little guys who, you know, would maybe otherwise struggle at working with the DoD. And your job is to be the liaison, find ways to either, you know, get them grants or seed money or small investments and start building up these things. Not because, hey, they've got a technology that's going to be militarily important tomorrow, but because they're working on things that could have significant military value farther into the future, and it's important to get them used to working with the DoD early in their existence.
And just like what you said with China, China is very authoritarian and autocratic. Do this, do that, etc. We're not. And I think what oftentimes is not really at the forefront in some of these conversations or arguments or fights, if you will, about whether or not we should do this, that, or the other thing, the military-industrial complexes, it might be private sector, but it is very much an institutionalized linchpin to our national security strategy. These private corporations are a part of our national defense plan, which I think has some interesting implications when you start thinking about some of the things we've talked about in this podcast before, like a sovereign state having a monopoly of violence within its borders. For the first time, we recently published a few years ago our first ever defense industrial strategy, because one way or another, these, like, they are as vital as anything else. They are not strictly a nationalized market. These are in fact private companies. And I mean, private citizens fighting for national defense or being involved in national defense is literally as old as this country. Is it New Hampshire that has that proud tradition of Minutemen, or is that Tennessee? I can't remember. No, Tennessee is the volunteer state.
Yeah, live free or die, New Hampshire.
I think pretty much all of America has the proud tradition of Minutemen, though. At least the 13 colonies.
I thought there was something specific New Hampshirean, but I guess.
Yeah, it was the Hampshire Grants back in the day.
Is that what it is?
Love it.
Yeah, it was like at one point, our militias, which are now generally referred to as National Guard, although like California still calls it the state militia, our militias were in fact volunteers, and oftentimes they were actual posses that were put together and then later licensed, like Teddy Roosevelt's famous Rough Riders during the Spanish-American War. So literally, he just gathered up a bunch of super strong-looking boyos, paid for a commission, and went on down to Cuba. And I think that's something that often gets forgotten, is that these private companies are not just those five, but all of the rest of the ones, like Sean talked about, the ones who are interested and willing to participate in national defense. They're as much a part of this nation's defense plan as the actual Department of Defense is. I don't know if that is hot enough to be a hot take, but I wrote hot take in front of that on my notes over here. So, Pete, I will now give you 30 seconds to say something.
Specifically what, though? I thought you kind of cleaned it up nicely.
I don't know.
Okay.
You generally have some sort of tangent to add, if not
is
four
the
of them.
Is the American military-industrial complex unique to the United States of America, or have we seen other things like this in similar forms around the rest of the world?
This really doesn't become a thing until probably around World War I, when you have like exponential growth in the variety of killing implements.
Yeah, the totalization of both war and the material to make war.
But yeah, so getting back to the actual topic.
Sorry, you asked me for a tangent. Talking about those
small companies and also talking about those defense innovation unit and how the government doesn't directly fund research and development anymore. I think that's a great point. And the segue is very nicely to a very specific company that I've really had in mind as a part of this topic that I was geeking out about just before we started recording, about one company in particular without making this sound like a product placement speech because nobody's paying me yet.
We're still looking
but
for sponsors. Anduril
Industries. Like, one, absolutely love the name because, Sean, do you recall what Anduril's namesake is? Just, do you have nerd lore? And if so, how deep does it go?
Nope. I don't.
That's okay. The blade that was broken.
Yeah.
Is that an insight?
No. It's a Lord of the Rings reference.
No, we were just fighting about it. It's the blade Aragorn inherits.
I should have known that then.
So in Elvish, that means Flame of the West. And I argue that that is a very deep metaphor.
Pete doesn't think it's this based to use his cool kid lingo.
I'm changing my mind. I think it is indeed based.
But like Flame of the West was the like poster child for cutting edge technology and up and coming defense contractor. That's the Flame of the West, iconically West, led by the U.S. Like I feel like all of that was very deliberate and super cool.
Mm. Oh, 100%. Right. If it's a company that big, like that wasn't an accident. That's well named. I like that. I didn't know that about them, and I admired their company. So that's just icing on the cake.
You go to their website, right? And you click on their mission tab because that was the closest thing I could find to an About Us. Because I was trying to be more adult about this podcast, I was actually trying to research some of the things before the podcast instead of Googling it during. But one of the things that they talk about that they list as some of their values or what have you is, unlike how the rest of the military industrial complex conventionally works, like we've talked about so many different times, Anduril doesn't believe in sitting around and waiting for the government to tell them something that the government needs. So they privately fund their own research and development, similar to every other venture capital you can think about. And then after that, they develop the product and then they bring it to, most notably, DIU just hired them for large diameter submersible, autonomous submersibles. So tying back into your DIU comment there.
Yeah, I want to touch on that real quick. Yeah, I wanted to correct myself on my DIU statement from earlier. I said a lot of times they're investing in companies that they don't have a quick, immediate military utility. I'm a little bit off the mark on that, right? So a lot of what they do is actually look at things that could have utility in, because they're doing stuff in the civilian realm that's useful, but they want it to spin off into the DoD market. So a lot of the stuff they invest in actually is closer to real-time usage than what I made it out to be. Mea culpa.
Have you watched Big Bang Theory ever?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Please, no, Joe. You're turning into a normie.
So at one point, Leonard, Sheldon, and Howard developed this really cool, like, perpetual momentum sort of replacement for GPS to like, enable infinite navigation capability in real time or something like that. And this Air Force colonel shows up out of nowhere. He's just like... Yeah. That just buys it. And after that, they're working in a top secret government lab for a hot minute after over-promising on it. That's just like when your explanation of how DIU works just made me immediately think of that.
Oh. Yeah. No, I think I've seen that.
Are you guys going to put it in a missile?
Because he's saying...
Well, that's... did you sign the contract? Well, that's none of your business.
Yeah. He made some sort of Star Wars or Star Trek reference, and Sheldon's just behind him losing his mind.
Yeah. Because he made a Star Trek reference thinking it was like Star Wars. Like, he conflated Star Wars and Star Trek. I remember that. Yeah. That's basically what you made me think of when you started describing DIU. This model that Anduril Industries is using, right? So funding their own research, like a venture capitalist company, with like they're preserving. I'm gonna keep harping on it because I feel like that's really what everybody genuinely cares about. Is we lost our competitive edge when it comes to military innovation, and we lost it because of this necessity of having to downsize everything and scale back the entire complex. We took out all the competitors and reduced the number to 5, and by sort of flipping this conventional model of defense contracting on end and funding their own research, they're keeping that competitive edge. They're modeled not after every other defense contractor, but they're more modeled after those venture capitalists that Sean was just talking about not even 20 minutes ago, because we're on time for a podcast for a change. Look at us.
So I just want to interject too real quick. I don't really even like the idea that, hey, we stopped innovating or we became less innovative because of these prime contractors. I think there's so many big structural things to take into account there, right? Like when we're having our hegemonic moment and, you know, breaking off our little piece of that peace dividend, right? Like, what need is there to innovate? When you look at the results of our first war with Iraq, right? Desert Storm. What in the world are you going to innovate for? Like, there's no clear need to try to innovate en masse in any particular area. We go into the war on terror, and we did tons of innovation. And the innovation wasn't aimed towards, you know, peer or near-peer threats. But when you look at, you know, we did force structure changes with BCTs. We invented, you know, a whole bunch of, you know, vehicles and, you know, MOSs and, you know, our targeting systems. We did a ton of innovative stuff and a ton of adaptation for those particular fights. It just wasn't stuff that was meant to address a peer threat.
I don't think any of us feel like it was a deliberate lack of innovation so much as it's something that it's sort of a stagnation that sets in over time. One of the things you talked about as a catalyst for innovation last time you were with us was like, you often see it from the people who just most recently lost. And if you're not losing, there's not much incentive there. Like what you said with the Gulf War. And like the F-35 program, that's famously $140-odd billion over budget or whatever it is after 30 years in process.
Don't worry. We'll make up for it after foreign sales.
Well, what happened there? Is it, whose fault is it? Well, long story short, mostly the government's fault because they keep tweaking things, right? So first the Air Force is like, we need this, the whole thing was going to just whatever. But the Air Force was like, we need a plane that does this.
Yeah, it's called feature creep.
It's even worse than that because you still have this good idea fairy vibe that comes in. It's like, hey, Air Force, you needed a plane that does a lot of these things. Navy, you need a slightly different plane that might be able to do similar things to the Air Force's plane. And Marine Corps, I guess you guys also need a plane too or whatever. So why don't you all just make the same plane and then we'll change a couple of widgets on the end? And so they try to mash these three APEX species together. And then as it's in development, people keep tweaking the scope, right? So, and so the contractors working on it are just like, you tell us what you want to do and we'll work on it, right? And so it's not a deliberate lack of innovation, but like that, I think there's something to be said for open market competition, bringing out the best without needing it. And so the F-35, it doesn't have that because we've already shrunk down to the 5 contractors, right? And at this point, it's pretty much the government, which the government decision-making doesn't really always have the best stereotypes about it, to say the least, right? And so it's very much government-forced rather than market space-driven. Does that kind of make more sense? And And so it's like, we'll do whatever you need us to do. But at the same time, nobody's out there figuring out what we actually need. So it's more like the government's trying to take a wild guess at what it needs. And so when you get into the situation with counterinsurgency, we can figure out pretty quick what we needed, right? Like going back to the MRAP example, we figured out real quickly that we needed a fairly IED-resistant vehicle. And so once we figured out we needed that, you snap your fingers and 13,000 of them rolled off of the conveyor belts at General Dynamics and whoever else was working on them. But that open market space of research and development, that's not alive anymore because we couldn't afford to sustain it after the Cold War ended and there wasn't an immediate need for it. With that gone, we can't really see what's coming. We can't see what we need. And that's why the venture capitalists end up inventing all of these cool things that DIU can then look at and be like, we can easily co-opt that into something for our national defense. And so I think that's when I talk competition, I'm meaning that competitive R&D atmosphere.
Yeah, but here's the thing though. We don't need a bunch of prime contractors to help us figure out what we need though, right? Like that's our job. That's the job of military and national security professionals to forecast what that future conflict might look like and forecast what sort of capabilities we need to have for it, right? So that's got nothing to do with the prime contractors. They've got nothing to do with us sitting there trying to figure out, hey, what are our threats? What are the likely flashpoints? What are the things that we're going to need to be successful? That's on the national security apparatus to try to figure that out, address it. And then they can put out, hey, we need someone building networked, small, capable drone swarms or something like that, right? They can put out their requirement. It's on them to decide what it is that they need. And if the prime contractors can make that stuff, hey, great, they can make it. And if it's a new tech startup somewhere else that's good at it, then, you know, maybe we can count on DIU to try to find those guys. But I don't like pointing at, you know, the industrial complex, these prime contractors, and be like, oh, without competition, we can't find the thing, we can't figure out what the thing is that we need. I don't think that should be industry's job to tell us what we need, or else you're opening the door to either buying things that you're told you need that you don't, or being told, hey, this is what you should be going with simply because it's what they're most capable of making, rather than because it's what's going to be most efficient for our national defense.
Well, I mean, I feel like we're already there. Like, do you both remember Jedi?
Not really.
Yeah. Yeah, the joint, sorry, for the audience, it's the Joint Enterprise Defense Infrastructure. Jedi. A cloud. It's like a giant Amazon cloud for the Department of Defense. Yeah.
Okay. I vaguely remember that. Yeah.
Well, so we were told we needed that. And so we immediately start working on that. And then it fills the cloud for the Department of Defense. After Amazon Web Services was already in existence and everything. Yeah. So that's like, it's not an accusation against the current military-industrial complex. It's an observation that back when we had tons of money to fund research and development at any number of these different R&D labs and other places out there, we were generating options. And then looking through those options, those other strategists or what have you could look at them and look at potential military applications for these new innovations. When you get rid of the entire mill industry market space because you can't afford to sustain that anymore because you're in a very resource-constrained environment, because you don't have an immediate need for urgent apex national defense industry, you peel back to the meat and potatoes. What do you need to have in order to maintain enough industry capability to maintain the strength of military that you think you need? And then, but that's focusing on what you think you needed now. And you're no longer thinking about what you're going to need next, because America stopped thinking about that because America wasn't worried about the Soviet Union anymore because they had dissolved. And so that's what I'm pointing to, that previous competitive market space. And it's not like that competitive market space disappeared. No, the defense industry consolidated to what it had, and a lot of the folks that were R&D experts or what have you went on to these different corporations. That skill set dissolves into the private sector. And from that private sector, you now have countless number of these venture capitalists, small startup companies, all doing really cool things the same way that government money used to fund specifically for military purposes. And then come bringing that full circle, you have DIU trying to rope all of these folks back in into this collaborative network to restore that sort of competitive atmosphere that we once had. And in the midst of that, we're now taking another look back at our military-industrial complex, looking at it like, how can we restore the flexibility we need in order to meet the needs that we see in our national security environment today?
I just don't know, right? Because I feel like when we talk about either the technological edge that we need to maintain, or if we just talk about having companies that can do the stuff we're going to need on the future battlefield, I'm just still not sure that that's something that we're missing, right? And to your point about how, hey, when we get to a fight, if we need to change, we can. And you hate to have to change after you're already in the fight, right? But when it comes to AI, when it comes to cyber capabilities, when it comes to software engineering, when it comes to, you know, automation and robotics and this stuff, I feel like we already have fantastic capabilities in the U.S. They just maybe aren't as driven right now to be working for the military. Like, that's not their sole focus. But I think if we look at history, that's been the example before, but should push come to shove, it works in our favor, right? Like, Ford wasn't, you know, a huge military producer early on in their history, but they were a world-leading auto manufacturer, right? The first to do assembly lines and this sort of stuff. And that had huge benefit for the U.S. when it went to war. You know, you look at World War II and what our auto industry contributed. The auto industry wasn't built on the back of supplying military hardware prior to that point. But because we had such a great edge in a lot of that manufacturing, it paid off when the need came, right? So, I mean, if we end up getting to a point where it's like, hey, we need AI-guided robotic logistics systems. Well, I mean, I think between Tesla and Amazon and some of the other big, powerful American companies, we've got the expertise in this country to make that happen in a pinch.
26 odd years later, after this decision to go to a sustainment mode of military-industrial complex, that's already happening. Like, this need for leading-edge innovation, all of this stuff has been realized and been working on it at least since 2016 when we announced we were working on it. Because that exact scenario, I think it is actually specifically Tesla too, Sean, where they've developed this leader, using their autopilot feature. Their Transcom's working on leader follower technology, so that you can replace some of the drivers with drone cargo trucks, basically, that are keyed to an actual manned and driven lead vehicle. So, like, that's all happening. So the bigger brains than ours have already figured out this need to reconnect the loop on research and development, military innovation, and military industrial complex capacity. And I think it is legitimately Tesla, but I'd have to go back and look.
To me, my more immediate concern when it comes to defense industry is stuff like, you know, if you had told me that, you know, Russia is going to invade Ukraine and the biggest issue would be the West's ability to supply artillery ammunition, I would have thought you were crazy, right? But that's a huge holdup that we've seen, and not just because, you know, Congress isn't passing bills to fund it, but because even with the funding going through, the manufacturing isn't there to meet the need of something that 155 shells, not technologically advanced, right? Not at all. And maybe because we're such a tech-heavy industry now, we struggle to keep up on that more basic manufacturing.
And ammunition is apparently the absolute, like, worst commodity in this regard, too. And it kind of makes sense that it's the worst when you think about it, because, like, it's got a really long shelf life relative to, like, food and water and things and fuel. And so, like, you'll make all of this in 1 year, and then you can make enough in 1 year that regular training consumption only, it lasts you 5 to 7 years. And so then, like, these ammo plants are then, like, letting people go or whatever over this time because there's just not the demand there. And so, like, the production track for this industry is just, like, peaks and troughs year over year. But yeah, I was reading about that too. It was like, wow, which is ironic because I personally didn't think field artillery was ever going to be a significant factor in the future with drones and stuff. But clearly I was mistaken.
Well, it's to your point though, right? The rub for these companies, you can say, hey, make more, we're going to pay you more money. So make more, right? And the rub is, you know, once you're doing shift work and working around the clock and that facility is making as much as they can, you have to do a really significant jump to make it worth that company's time to build an additional production facility, right? And if you don't make that sort of investment, then there's just a certain asymptote that they're going to approach where you're not getting more without a massive investment. And that massive investment could be a waste a year later when you no longer need it.
Yeah, because why bother making that plant if you and I both know that your orders are going to taper off in 5 years to next to nothing again? It makes no sense to put eggs in that basket. Absolutely.
And on that bombshell.
All right. Hey, well, this was a great talk. I think we covered some bare basics for like a mill industry 101 kind of episode. So thank you both for joining us on this fine evening. Sean, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks again for coming, Sean. I know it's taking some of your time.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. Well, we will see you all next time. I'm going to hit the stop button now.